From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. Colonel Margaret Kammermeier is the highest-ranking official to challenge the military's anti-gay policy. After a distinguished career as an Army nurse, she declared her lesbianism and was discharged. In June, a federal court ordered her reinstated, but the government is appealing that decision. On today's Fresh Air, Margaret Kammermeier tells her story. She has a new memoir. Also, from the documentary film Hoop Dreams, we talk with filmmaker Steve James and basketball player Arthur Agee. The film traces the lives of Agee and another young man from inner-city Chicago with dreams of making it in the NBA. That and more coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The man accused of shooting at the White House over the weekend will get a psychiatric evaluation. Federal Magistrate Deborah Robinson has ordered the test for Francisco Duran of Colorado Springs, Colorado. Duran has been formally charged with four offenses related to the shooting incident, but a prosecutor says a handwritten letter connected to Duran raises questions about his competency. Duran will next appear in court on Wednesday. The Census Bureau has released a report detailing who has health insurance and who doesn't. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
The Census Bureau found that during the 1990 to 1992 survey, blacks, Hispanics, and poor people were most likely to lack health insurance. People who fell below the poverty line for a year or two were twice as likely to lack health insurance at some point as people who remained below the poverty line the whole time. A Census Bureau analyst suggests that the temporarily poor are less likely to qualify for or apply for Medicaid, the government program that would pay their health care bills. The Census Bureau also found that 76% of Americans consistently had health insurance in the early 1990s. That's a slight improvement over the 74% who had insurance in the late 1980s. But the bottom line was less rosy. 60 million Americans lacked health insurance for at least 1 month during the survey. This is Joanne Silberner reporting.
President Clinton says Republicans are threatening Social Security and other entitlement programs. The president made the charge in Philadelphia, where he's kicked off a week of campaigning for embattled Democratic candidates. Pennsylvania Democratic candidates or Senate candidate Harris Wofford is facing Republican Congressman Rick Santorum. A new poll for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette finds Santorum in the lead with 46% to Wofford's 35%. The second in a series of satellites that studies solar wind will be sent into orbit tomorrow from Florida. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
It's called the Wind Satellite, and it will do just that, orbit the Earth while observing powerful solar winds that are believed to affect electrical power on Earth. Scientists say electrified particles are sent hurling toward Earth every time the sun sends up a solar flare. Most of the particles skip across Earth's magnetic field, but some penetrate, affecting power lines and other conductive materials. The Wind Satellite will be sent aloft by a Delta II rocket and will spend its first year on Earth's day side, between the sun and Earth's magnetic field. The research is the product of international cooperation and marks the first time a Russian science instrument will fly aboard a U.S. spacecraft. Liftoff is set for 4:31 a.m. Eastern Time from the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 19.5 points to 3,911. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is up a point and a half. This is NPR. The president of Algeria says a presidential election will be held before the end of 1995. The country is struggling between the military-backed government and a Muslim fundamentalist insurgency. The Algerian leader didn't say when the election would be held, but the announcement seems to shorten the previously announced transition to elected rule by 1 year. The insurgency has claimed the lives of more than 11,000 people since January 1992. Two prison escapees in Germany seized several hostages and robbed a bank as part of a cross-country crime spree. Police haven't been able to catch up with them. NPR's Dieter Berger has more from Frankfurt.
The one-day road odyssey began early in the day when the criminals seized two off-duty police officers in Stuttgart in southern Germany. The men then forced the police to help them rob a bank later in Fulda in the center of Germany, where they took more than $150,000. The two officers were later released in eastern Germany, where the gangsters captured an adult and two children. These hostages were also released later, and three adults were seized. The two men have stolen several cars, briefly holding hostage at least one driver. The 32 and 35-year-old robbers escaped earlier this month from a prison in Hamburg. One of them, a former East German Army officer, was serving a life sentence for murder. Police say both are heavily armed. I'm Dietra Berger in Frankfurt.
The latest poll in the California Senate race suggests Democrat Dianne Feinstein is pulling away from Republican challenger Michael Huffington. The nonpartisan field poll shows Feinstein has 45% and Huffington with 39%. A survey last month found the two even at 43%. The poll's margin of error is plus or minus 3.4%. The new survey comes after a revelation from Huffington, who employed an illegal alien as a nanny for his children. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. In 1989, Colonel Margaret Kammermeyer was a highly decorated Army nurse who had served 23 years in the military. During a routine interview for a top-secret military clearance for a new job, she was asked if she was a lesbian, and she told the truth, that she was. That set off a series of events that led to Kammermeyer's dismissal from the military in 1992 for violating their no homosexuals policy. Months later, Bill Clinton came to office and a modified don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue policy went into effect. Without the kind of support from the government that gays in the military had hoped for, they've turned to the courts. Colonel Kammermeyer won her case in federal district court and was reinstated this past summer. Kammermeyer has returned to the VA hospital in Tacoma, Washington, where she works as a clinical specialist. Meanwhile, the U.S. Justice Department is fighting her reinstatement. Margaret Kammermeyer has just written a memoir called Serving in Silence. I asked her why she admitted she's a lesbian to the military.
It was where I was, the point I had gotten to after a lot of ups and downs in my life, and come to understand that my perception was that I was a lesbian.
Was there any second thoughts that you had? Or I know that you hesitated, as you write about it, and you thought first.
Well, it was just that momentary, well, I'm supposed to answer this. And so then I made the statement, I am a lesbian. And as he sort of diverted from the rest of his questions, I had this sinking feeling that perhaps my military career was over.
And the moment that you heard that your discharge was official, what was the effect on you?
I felt negated. This was 26 years into my military career. I felt stripped of an identity, that I knew that I was taking off the uniform for the last time and did not know myself, essentially, without a uniform, and felt very, very lonely. And, you know, in some peculiar ways, felt that I was the only one who had had this experience.
Did you feel angry at the military?
I think I felt more hurt, you know, hurt. How could, I mean truly a victim of a system. And then there was this sense of, when I did get home that day, I couldn't get my uniform off fast enough, but it hurt so much at the same time that, you know, it was like I needed to put it away. I didn't want to burn it, but rather to put it away so that I didn't have to look at it because of the pain. And there were all of these emotions that went with it. But I'm not sure that anger was one of them.
What did the military offer you then as a profession, as a career? This is something that you chose. You were born in Norway. You came to the States with your family when you were a young girl. And yet it seemed that the military was the perfect occupation as far as you were concerned. What did it offer you? Well, what does it offer you?
Well, I think there were a number of different things. One, I was the firstborn of an immigrant family. Thought that I was sort of to pave the way for my siblings, and at the same time to pay a debt to America. And one way of doing that was to serve in the military.
A debt for what?
for accepting us as immigrants to America. So that was one part of it. The other was that when I left my first year of college, I had such a wonderful time, sort of feeling like a free spirit, which obviously meant that I didn't do a whole bunch of schoolwork. And so I didn't do well in school, and my ambition to become a physician, I felt, you know, was just not going to be achievable. And, you know, the roles of women primarily in the 50s were teachers, nurses, or mothers. I wasn't interested in getting married, and so that really left nursing as sort of the bottom of the barrel profession, which it, you know, it was a very subservient
kind of a handmaiden to doctors.
You know, it's the kind that makes me nauseated even thinking about you know, the perception that in those days that one had of nursing. I feel very different about it now, but certainly at that time. And so joining the military was a way of at least putting some meaning behind it, and that you put on a uniform, you'd be where the action was, you would be there on the front line when the soldiers were defending the nation. And so it again was that sense of meaning.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about your family. As you said, you're the oldest of four children.
Yes.
And you have three younger brothers. Your family was from Norway, immigrated here. And you write about the fact that your father, in a kind of, I guess, writing about the family, wrote, "I have three children." And you assumed he was referring to your three brothers and not you. What was your place then within the family?
Well, you, again, have to put it into the social context of his experience. The world revolved. He's now 83. And his perception was that families are organized around the family name and the patriarchy of the family. And my brothers carried the family name. I did not, because the expectation would be that I would marry and take my husband's name. And so that's why there was no daughter. And I think I had always had that perception, always trying in some way to please my father, to get some recognition for existing, and in later years recognizing that the child in me was never going to get his approval because I was a girl, a woman. And I think that my sense of, gotcha, was when I finished my PhD and he, as a physician, said, and as close as he could say that he was proud of me, he said, "You know, I should have gotten my PhD." As though that was in some way a goal that he hadn't achieved and that I had done well. But, you know, that's sort of the backwards way, I think, of looking at, you know, you're okay.
Let me ask you then about meeting your husband, which you did, Harvey. You met him in 1964. And up until that time, it sounded like you weren't particularly interested in men. You dated maybe a little bit, but it wasn't a central part of your life. What was it about him that made you want to marry him?
I couldn't answer that. I think what was happening, it was we dated for a year by the time we finally married, that we ended up spending time together. We would go sightseeing. You know, we were both stationed in the same place. We were both tall. We both skipped fourth grade. We were both of Northern European extraction, both raised in Lutheran churches, both the eldest of four children, and we looked good together. And
that was reason enough? Those are reasons enough?
He was a very nice person. And when, after dating for a long time, he asked me to marry him, my thoughts were, why not? And I couldn't come up with any real reasons. because I didn't know any. I had sort of seen role models of this is, you know, how life goes on, and women meet somebody and then they're supposed to get married. So I thought this was part of that natural transition. And so we got married and had, you know, 15 years of traveling around, of both of us serving in Vietnam, of coming back from Vietnam, raising a family, being on a very busy circuit of doing things and doing more and more things, each of us in our own way, and coming to the point for me that why was it that I was so busy doing things and yet feeling so fragmented and so distraught at the end that I contemplated suicide and then ended up getting some help.
Did you feel you had anyone that you could talk to at the time? I know you went to see a therapist, but was there anyone that you could share some of your doubts with, some of your questions with, your anxieties?
No, I think, you know, I did spend some time with a counselor, there were a few friends that, you know, certain aspects of things I could talk about, but you know, it was still a very personal thing, and you know, it wasn't anything I could grab onto. You know, I spent time reading, I spent time trying to figure things out, and over. And once I did decide that I needed to divorce, and we spent that, I spent a year in the area around the kids. Some things got better, and some things felt really as though they were getting worse, and that had to do with my ex-husband by that time, his reaction to me. It was sort of if I didn't want to be married, that must mean that I was homosexual. And, you know, that in itself was such an ugly accusation that it didn't feel right. It was with all of the labels of hate and vehemence against me was such a painful time. It was like if you have a wound that has a scar on it, I mean, a scab on it, and you rip off the scab, you know, it just gets deeper and deeper and more painful.
Is it still painful?
Talking about it is painful because it is like reliving the experience. Those things don't change.
Well, let me ask you about an incident, and you write about it in the book. And after you had separated, you were bringing your children home. Back to your husband's house or your ex-husband's house, and he started to yell at you, and he called you a faggot, a queer, a dyke. And then the children started chanting the same thing, I guess, at his encouragement. How did you understand it at that time? Because I got the feeling that at that point you weren't thinking that you were lesbian. You didn't know what was going on,
no.
But here you were being called these things.
Well, whenever he was there to meet the kids after we'd had visitation, that was how the visitation ended, with him standing there, the hands holding onto the hands of the boys, and in chorus making these chants. And I think first because I didn't acknowledge that perhaps I was. All I knew was that I didn't want to be in a relationship with a man, and he was certainly giving me every reason to feel that was justified by how he was acting. And then feeling that not only was he promoting the alienation with the kids, but the pain associated with that.
After you left the family and your husband got custody of the children, and you went down to San Francisco, down to California to try to sort things out, I guess, and figure out what your life was going to be like. What were some of the, and I know it was painful for you to be away from your children, and you saw them when you could. What were some of the things that you wanted to think about, or was it just to get away and try to live a life that was just much more simple than what it had been.
Well, you have to put it into, again, the perspective of I had come from a patriarchal house, lived at a protected university, joined a protective patriarchal military, married an authoritarian husband, and now for the first time in my life, I was on my own. And who was I? And was I okay as a person, as a nurse, as an army officer? And trying to put those pieces together again.
Well, let me reintroduce you. And I'm speaking today with Margaret Kammermeier, and she's written a book about her life and about her experience in the military. The book is called Serving in Silence. And Margaret Kammermeier was discharged from the Army because in answer to a question about her sexual orientation, she answered, "I am a lesbian." She has been reinstated, although her case is still under appeal. And we're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Margaret Kammermeier. We're talking about her book called Serving in Silence. You write about your own homophobia, your own fears about homosexuals, about lesbians, about gays. How did you come to terms with that?
Well, again, it's what I knew was what I'd been taught. I had seen pictures of, quote, homosexuals in my father's old medical books. So I knew that they looked different also. And so that was the stereotype that I was raised with. And I think in the course of my own development, emotional understanding about myself was what, if I was a homosexual, I didn't fit that stereotype. But because of my emotional affiliations, I must be. And so as I read and as I heard and understood more about what human sexuality and sexual orientation was all about, by the time I had met Diane, it felt like, well, this must be who I am. And so there's the difference between sort of labeling yourself perhaps as homosexual and coming to understand your sexual orientation as a gay person or a gay man or a lesbian. And by the time the investigation came up, when the question was asked having to do with homosexuality, it seemed like this was the natural thing for me to say.
It was the culmination of all these years of experience and thought.
Yeah, and just this is what fit.
What's it been like for you since you've been reinstated? I mean, your case is still, I guess, making its way through the courts. But what's it like for you to be out, I guess, and in your old occupation?
Well, I am not out. I am in. I mean, in terms of the military, I am in the military, but really am not at liberty to talk about anything. And so people come up, they say, "Welcome back," you know, and I get a standing ovation when I return to the unit. And it's as though, supposed to be, as though nobody knows anything and nothing's happened in between, and just to pick up from 2 years ago.
Is that possible to do?
Well, I think it is rather ludicrous to think anything like that could happen. And, you know, the irony being that I was reinstated for my July drill, and in the Wednesday military paper, it says, "Lesbian colonel returns to the military." And it's like, all right, I've been outed by the military, but I'm not supposed to say anything. And so there's this hypocrisy of just like the lives of the people who are in the military now under the don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue. It's as though, first of all, it's as though it's being followed, which it's not. You know, people are asked. Sometimes when even in what one presumed would be privileged conversations, they are asked and reported, the witch hunts begin, and there's an organization now called the Service Members Legal Defense Network to be available to help service members who fear for their careers because of the harassment that is taking place under the new policy.
Well, let me ask you, if the new policy, which as you say is don't ask, don't tell, don't pursue, if that were followed to the letter of the law, would that improve the condition of gays and lesbians in the military?
Let's see. If you are denied your humanity, but you're allowed to pretend that you have only a professional life, that it's a little bit like if you're a very religious person, but you're not allowed to practice your religion, or you can't let anybody know what that religion is, but it is part of your humanity, does that make your life easier? We also know that the misuse of power and position by certain people within the military has existed through the sexual harassment of women, where women are presumed not to be interested in careers. So obviously, if and to have absolutely no discretion with regard to who they spend their time. So if they rebuff someone's sexual advances, they can be labeled and be investigated. And it's not as though that's something that sounds foreign, because there are case after case after case of testimonials of people who have experienced this. And as long as this sort of a law remains in the book, that misuse of power, misuse of position is there towards any group of people.
Do you think this will finally be decided one way or the other by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, the courts, because the policy was codified by Congress, it means that unless Congress says, let's get rid of this law and make it into a personnel policy that the Department of Defense can adjust as they find that it's not a problem that we have created, that unless they do that, then the only way to challenge the unconstitutional aspects of this policy is through the courts. And some of us are in court based on the old policy.
Which is true in your case,
which
right?
is true in my case. And others are in class action suits challenging the new policy. And some individuals are also challenging the new policy. And so we have no option. There are no options other than these two avenues at this point.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Colonel Margaret Kammermeyer's memoir, Serving in Silence, has just been published. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Like many kids in his neighborhood, Arthur Agee had a dream to make it big in basketball, to play for the NBA. His story and that of another young man became the subject of the documentary Hoop Dreams. Coming up, we talk with Arthur Agee and filmmaker Steve James. And world music critic Milo Miles tells us about the new collection of Sam Cooke's Saar recordings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. There's been another denunciation of the Republican contract with America. The latest broadside is from the Concord Coalition, a public interest group working to cut the national deficit. UPI's Pi Chamberlain prepared this report.
Coalition co-chairman Warren Rudman, a former Republican senator from New Hampshire, says that without major changes, as it stands,
contract with America would end up with a larger deficit than we have now, and the net result of that would be higher interest rates and higher inflation, which would destroy any gain that anyone received from it.
He said the problem with the so-called contract is that it would increase spending on defense by billions of dollars while cutting taxes by billions, so that the government would have to go in debt even more than it does now. Pi Chamberlain, Washington.
Three regional phone companies say they're teaming up with a powerful Hollywood agency to offer TV shows and interactive entertainment over phone lines. Bell Atlantic, 9X, and Pacific Telesis say the system should be up late next year. They and the Creative Artists Agency of Hollywood will offer customers in trial markets the chance to order videos over traditional phone lines. They eventually want to offer home shopping, electronic games, personalized news, and interactive advertising. Researchers say bat populations are falling dramatically all over the country. Jill Hoyt of member station KBSU reports from Boise.
The Interior Department says 40% of the nation's bat populations are either threatened or endangered. Environmentalists hope to dispel myths about bats that loom large each Halloween. Scientists say bats are good for the economy and the environment because they eat insects that harm crops and forests. Bats are also crucial for pollinating and dispersing seeds in tropical rainforests. Bats live in caves, as well as the thousands of abandoned mines that dot the American West. Environmentalists are installing gates over these mines to maintain bat habitat while preventing people from falling in. Rather than being afraid of bats, scientists say man is by far the biggest destroyer of them. For National Public Radio, I'm Jill Hoyt in Boise, Idaho.
The confessed killer of Mexican presidential candidate Luis Donaldo Colosio has been sentenced to 42 years in prison. The judge handed down the sentence to Mario Martinez, who shot the ruling party candidate in Tijuana in March. The Angolan government and the rebel UNITA group have initialed a peace accord intended to stop nearly 20 years of civil war. The treaty was initialed after a year of peace talks backed by the UN. The civil war has devastated Angola. Hundreds of thousands of people have died. Millions have fled their homes. On Wall Street, stock prices closed lower today. The Dow fell 22.5 points to end the day at 3,908. Trading was heavy. This is NPR. Business and government leaders from more than 60 countries have gathered in Morocco for an economic summit intended to find ways to transform the Middle East. The conference is reportedly provoking strong criticism from some Arab governments. The BBC's Simon Ingram reports.
Images of politicians and businessmen from Israel and Arab countries mingling amicably in Casablanca may bring cheer to the outside world, but in the Middle East there are some who feel nothing less than dread. The sharpest attacks have come from countries most opposed to the current peace process. Libya spoke of a plan to strip the Arab world of its resources. Iraq, which like Iran was not invited to Casablanca, said the meeting served only Zionist interests. In Syria and Lebanon, where the governments turned down invitations to attend, commentators said the event should have been held only after a full Arab-Israeli peace settlement had been achieved. there's been hostile comment, too, from Islamic and left-wing opposition groups in Egypt, whose 15-year-old peace treaty with Israel has yielded little in the way of economic cooperation.
Simon Ingram reporting. A longtime associate of actor Bob Crane has been acquitted today of charges he murdered the actor 16 years ago. Prosecutors alleged John Henry Carpenter had worried that Crane would end a friendship that had provided him with sexual partners. Jurors in Phoenix deliberated 2.5 days before finding the 67-year-old Carpenter innocent of the murder charge. Crane played the wisecracking Colonel Robert Hogan in the television comedy series Hogan's Heroes. The Supreme Court is going to look at the University of Virginia's refusal to subsidize a student-run Christian magazine. The group says it's unfairly being singled out and says the Constitution just demands neutrality toward religion, not hostility. Lower courts disagree. They say the university's decision agrees with the required separation of church and state. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Filmmaker Steve James has been a basketball fan for years, played the game through school, and dreamed for a time of playing professionally. That never happened, but back in 1986, he and several colleagues got the idea of making a film about basketball as it's played on the inner-city playgrounds of Chicago. With the help of a basketball scout, they found William Gates and Arthur Agee, two talented youngsters who live for the game and dreamed one day of playing for the National Basketball Association. James and fellow filmmakers Frederick Marks and Peter Gilbert spent 5 years filming these two young men and their families as they struggled with schoolwork, family crises, money problems, and the hard-edged world of competitive athletics. William Gates and Arthur Agee are both in college now and still playing basketball. We caught up with Arthur Agee, a junior at Arkansas State University, who's studying communications and playing on the college team, and with filmmaker Steve James in Chicago to talk about the making of the film Hoop Dreams. First, I asked Arthur to tell us what it's like having a camera following you around for 5 years.
At first, you're so happy that the camera's there. You this 14-year-old kid. You got these white people following you with cameras and stuff, you're just going to have a smile on your face all day long. You're going to be eager to tell somebody too.
Yeah.
But just by having them around all the time, it was fun. But then in some situations, like in the film, when it was getting tough and, my family was, breaking down and everything. But, you forget the camera's there,
Well, let me ask you, Steve, because this is a film about basketball, but it's also a very intimate portrait of two families. And as Arthur was just saying, there's some scenes that you see in the family that are difficult. I mean, these are families, like all families, that are struggling. What was it like for you to be invited in to the inside of these families, and what's your impression of them?
We did, in fact, capture a lot of very intimate moments, a lot of very hard moments. I mean, when you see Arthur on the playground and his dad shows up after his dad has left home and is living on the streets, and you watch his dad go and make a drug buy in front of Arthur, it rips your heart out.
Well, Arthur, and in that scene, your father has left the family. He comes back and he's playing basketball with you. And then you're right. You do go see him making a drug buy, and the camera looks at you, and you're looking at your father. And I couldn't help but wondering what was, first of all, going through your head, and how do you feel about that incident in your family life being shown on film?
Well, I hadn't seen him for a couple of months, and just for him to walk up like that was, the camera was there, and he probably was so much on drugs then, he said he didn't even see the, cameras over there, So when he left, I was truly embarrassed, because all my friends and everything was out there, and those guys, they pretty much, when he was on drugs, they pretty much teased me about it, saying that your dad was on crack and he's a crackhead and things like that. But, when it was there and the camera, it showed me, I kind of like had my head down. I was like hoping that, that he'd leave.
Yeah.
But he had went over there to this guy over there. His name was Pulaski Slim. And he sold drugs. And I was like, I looked over at him He was so gone, he didn't even look back to even see, you know, was I looking at him or was the cameras there or nothing. In a way, I'm kind of glad that it did happen because people need to see what goes on in the inner city is real. This happened for real in my life and just happened a couple of years ago, you know.
Well, and we also see your father coming back to the family, and we see him supporting you in as best he can, I guess. At one point, he says, "I'm an example of what not to do." And it looks as if you've had a difficult relationship with him. I don't know what your relationship with him is now, but it's more than just this drug buy that we see.
Yeah. When he first came back to the family, I didn't really accept him. You know, I stayed away. I stayed gone all the time. I kind of kept my distance from him, and I always kept telling my mom, to put him out, to divorce him, to just tell him you can't take him back no more, cause you know all the pain and hurt he put us through. But you know, my mom, you know, they've been married for 25 some years, so she stayed with him, I kind of hurt me that, I would always say, oh, man, she's stupid. You know, why is she doing this? He ain't going to do nothing but keep on hurting us, smoking cocaine, or, going to do the same thing. But when he came back, he started going to church and everything and getting real religified and, started getting real into the Lord. And he always used to talk about, give me advice and everything. And coming, he was showing up to my basketball games. That's what most surprised me. But now our relationship is more of a brother-like relationship. Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm more closer with my dad right now than I am with my little brother.
Arthur, I want to ask you about something that your mother says, and she's making you a cake for your 18th birthday. Mm. And she says, she's so proud of you and so thrilled that this is your 18th birthday, but she also says there are a lot of kids in this neighborhood who never make it to 18, and she's just so thankful that you have, that you're still alive.
Yeah, she made that statement because a lot of kids in my neighborhood where I live, they don't even get to make it to 15 or 16, but I think because of my mom and because of the basketball, that was because if that wasn't in my life, I think I would have reverted to drugs and selling with my friends and everything. But because that was there and because I had a strong mom and because I, when things got bad at home, I always, can go play basketball and play by myself and think on the court, think about a lot of things. But I'm glad that was there because there also was a couple of drug dealers out there that was, it was a couple of times that I wanted to sell drugs, but the drug dealers, they knew the things that I was going through. They knew that I was playing basketball and I had they had a little talent. So they kind of steered me away from them. They kind of steered me away from out there selling drugs. But I thank them for doing that because it got me to where I'm at today.
And do you mean that you actually approached them and they said, "No, Arthur, you got something better than this"?
Yeah, one time, like when our lights got cut off, I was gonna go out there, what they call is a slang term, slanging rocks, slanging cocaine on the corner. I kind of made a joke about it. I said, I'm finna start slanging like that, and like three of them looked at me like, cause they knew my mom, my dad, they knew, that I wasn't like that, that I had a curfew and I couldn't be out there all at them late night hours. But they looked at me and they was like, "Man, you crazy. You ain't doing this. You might as well just go back over there in the playground and play some more basketball."
So you took their advice?
Yeah.
More about basketball and the film Hoop Dreams after a short break. My guests are filmmaker Steve James and college basketball player Arthur Agee. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Arthur Agee and Steve James talking about the making of the documentary, Hoop Dreams. one of the stories within the story is the fact that these two young guys get recruited for this very nice suburban high school, Catholic suburban high school called St. Joseph's. And Arthur was at the school for a while and then went back to the local public school. And William was here for through his high school years. Compare and contrast the two high schools that we see in this film.
Well, St. Joseph's is in Westchester, which is a mostly white suburb, and the school is made up of mostly white kids from the middle class. It's a suburban Catholic private school, which also has a grand basketball tradition that really began with Isaiah Thomas, who was its greatest star and Arthur's idol.
Right.
Marshall, like a lot of inner-city public schools around the country, it has very few resources. So it's a very poor inner-city, you know, high school in Chicago, which is unfortunately legendary for graduating an extremely low rate of kids.
And for you, Arthur, what was it like to go to the suburban school? And it was a 90-minute ride by public transportation to get out there.
For me, it was like, you know, it was like going to Princeton or Harvard. Because, you know, it was away from the city, away from, the trash in the city and everything. Out there was much cleaner in the suburbs and, you know, a lot much cleaner bus rides. And actually, I did like the bus rides because, you know, you could think a lot and, you know, you didn't have any loud people getting on the bus or nobody, gangbangers or nothing like that. But out there, I thought very highly of the school, though.
Arthur, did you feel like you were under a lot of pressure and certainly you're a gifted basketball player? We see coaches being tough, being demanding. We see your parents coming and obviously enjoying your success on the court. Did that also feel like pressure to you?
No, I didn't because I blocked all that out. You know, I didn't, after all my pressure was when my family was apart when everything was broken down and no lights and all that. That's the pressure I had when I was in school then. But when everything came together my senior year and my dad, everybody started coming to the games, I didn't have no pressure on me at all. They didn't apply any pressure on me. The coaches or my mom, my dad, no one, even my friends, they was like, do the best you can. And they never said that you had to hit this jump shot or you got to do this to be good or whatever, you know.
Did you, though, feel the pressure that you had to be good all the time so that a college would want you?
Yeah, I thought that. I mean, I thought that I had to go out and play smart and play good every night that a college would, you know, want to give me a scholarship.
Arthur, you went to junior college after graduating from Marshall. You're now at Arkansas State University. Do you still dream about the NBA?
Yes, I do. I feel that I always tell people this, that the dream for me isn't finished until I receive my degree here and that I play pro ball in the NBA or somewhere pro ball. If it's not the NBA, I'm not gonna cry about it. It's not gonna feel like my life is gone or, you know, I gotta go out and kill someone. But you know, if I don't make it, then I don't make it. I'm quite sure I have other things that I can fall back on, you know, because I have my degree. I'm definitely gonna pursue that.
And for you, Steve James, as a director, what would you say your relationship with Arthur Agee and William Gates and their families is?
Well, they're like family to us. I mean, that happened during the course of making this film, and you know, they will be family to us, you know, for the rest of our lives. I mean, even though we stopped filming in 91, we have regular contact. We do things together. We have continued to have regular contact with the families over the course of the last 3 years. I mean, I think that's one of the things that, one of the real joys of making this film, you know, yes, we ended up with a compelling story and the film is getting a lot of critical acclaim and all the twists and turns of this story make for great drama that we captured. But I think, you know, the really lasting thing that happened is that we became dear friends, if not extended family, to these inner city families that we never would have come in contact with except to make this film. Because, I don't know, it's like in our society, black people and white people, even if they're in the same school, have so little contact with each other.
Yep.
And
would you agree, Arthur?
Yeah, I would.
Do you see Steve and the other people as an extended family?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I just got to talking to Peter last night for about an hour and a half. They always call and leave messages all the time saying they were just thinking about me. And, you know, when I come home, you know, we come home, we always, you know, get together. We go out and eat and, you know, they come over. And, it's, you know, by them being around, they like real family.
Well, I thank you both very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Okay.
And thank Arthur, you. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Steve, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
Arthur Agee is a junior at Arkansas State University and is one of the young men profiled in the new documentary film, Hoop Dreams, made by filmmaker Steve James. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered today. Robert, what stories do you have for us?
Well, news today that the government has ordered a psychiatric evaluation of Francisco Martin Duran, the man accused of firing a semi-automatic weapon at the White House. Also, a report from California on the many demonstrations against Proposition 187. That's the ballot proposition that would make it illegal to give public education or free medical care to the children, even the families, of illegal aliens. Also today, a story about the meaning of the story of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and a Halloween story from Cameroon, a ghost story in any case, to be told by Georges Collinet, the host of NPR's Afropop Worldwide.
Robert, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Even with the flood of reissues that have come out on CD, some pop music treasures have remained out of circulation until now. Critic Milo Miles celebrates the appearance of Sam Cooke's Sar Records story. Sar Records was active only from 1959 to 1965, but Milo says that every one of the tracks on the retrospective holds delightful moments.
Way back in the 70s, I had a list of singles about a mile long that I wanted. The list got shorter and shorter over the years, but a stubborn few eluded me. Right near the top were Looking for a Love and It's All Over Now by the Valentinos, a mostly teenage group of Bobby Womack and his four brothers. I knew they were on Sar Records, a label that Sam Cooke had started. But since you couldn't seem to find any Sar Records of any sort, the Valentinos were especially sacred. No, I wasn't interested in Bobby Womack's remakes of the songs. Now that the two CDs of Sam Cooke's Sar Records story are out, I'm delighted to confirm they're full of the tingling dynamite I dreamt about for decades. The one flaw is that it's a bit pricey. The one big surprise on the record for me was the Sims twins. This song of theirs appeared in a very famous cover version.
Girl at all, I'll just tell her.
It's Sam and Dave, right? Except that it's the guys that inspired Sam and Dave in every way, and they hit the same lofty peaks with their harmonies. And they do it the way Sam Cooke wanted. Smooth and sassy, classy and funky, all at the same time. He wanted to show you could get a big label sparkle from a black-owned organization. The whole Sar record story is infused with Sam Cooke's rapturous sense of how sacred gospel and sexual soul flow together unbroken. One CD is devoted to church songs, and danged if it doesn't contain a number, Couldn't Hear Nobody Pray by the Womack Brothers, which is the Valentinos plus their father. Turned into a lust song, Couldn't Hear Nobody Pray became Looking for a Love, though I don't think the Jay Giles Band would have tackled the gospel version.
Father, I couldn't hear nobody pray. I couldn't hear nobody,
pray.
Sam Cooke's Sar record story overflows with exultant performances from the likes of Johnny Taylor, Mel Carter, and the now-forgotten but deeply gritty blues wailer Johnny Morissette. The Sam Cooke sides are delicious but minor. The Womacks really steal the show, both in gospel and soul. And yes, the last track on the set is my beloved It's All Over Now, the Rolling Stones' first U.S. hit restored to its original version. Don't worry, Stones fans, Keith Richards or Brian Jones added the wondrous rowdy guitar figure at the end of the song. But as for the Valentinos' vocal and their rhythm section, well, as another big crossover guy put it, you can't touch this.
Milo Miles writes about world music and pop music for the New York Times, the Village Voice, and the Boston Globe. He reviewed Sam Cooke's Sar record story on Abco Records. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, opera's crossover star Dawn Upshaw. She has a new album of Broadway songs. I hope you'll join us.
Jenny made her mind up when she was 3. She herself was going to trim the Christmas tree. Christmas Eve, she lit the candles, tossed the tapers away. Little Jenny was an orphan on Christmas Day. Poor Jenny, bright.